This is the London FinTech Podcast, brought to you by your host, Mike Ballaman, bridging the worlds of suits and t-shirts, of finance and technology, bringing you insights, stories, and inspiration from the golden age of opportunity and innovation happening in London right now.
Hi, this is Mike Ballaman, and this is London FinTech Podcast, episode 52. I'm delighted to welcome John Vollmer, CEO of R5FX, to talk about the realpolitik of being a growing fintech. John was one of the early guests on the show, entirely synchronicitously being show number 5. Now he's back, older, wiser, and more rotund. R5 offers a new electronic marketplace for emerging market foreign exchange and electronic non-deliverable forwards. Upcoming regulation requires foreign exchange trading banks to drastically change their current trading channels for the BRICS and other emerging market NDF currency pairs. Today, these currencies are currently traded and fixed over a number of old, difficult to track and inefficient methods. The market is opaque and liable to imperfect price movements to the detriment of bank customers and consumers, hence regulators' desire for change. R5 is building the emerging marketplace for FX banks that not only satisfies these new legal requirements, but also specializes in the fast-growing transaction volumes in BRIC and emerging economy currencies. But that's quotes just, unquotes, R5. More importantly, John is one of the very few CEOs who's made the journey from fintech startup to fintech scale-up. They have a prestigious single-figure millions investment from Deutsche Börse and now have offices in London and Singapore. Like many fintechs growing up, they've also come into more real contact and competition with existing marketplace. Without even mentioning LendingClub's recent troubles, it's true to say that not one fintech has actually yet meaningfully dented the profits of the incumbents. And surprise, surprise, incumbents are rather more used to competition than the fintech fluffy bunnies ever admit or frankly even know. What is that journey like? What is it all like where we are now? What in prior and what in existing narratives around fintech is bullshit, hype, or fantasy? What are the differences that matter at the coalface of competition for clients? Where's it all going? Why are we here? And much, much more. Plenty to talk about, so let's get on with the show. Hi, John. Thanks for joining me today.
Hi, Mike. Thanks very much. Thank you for inviting me. Good to see that we're both still here almost 2 years later, but a shame that I didn't get into episode number 50, but episode 5 to episode 52 is still a pretty good journey.
Well, you know, one of the things about being an ever-expanding, actually waistline, but that's going down more recently, ever-expanding podcast, you see, is that you can sort of ask more on the bribery front, and frankly, your offer just wasn't there enough to get the big, prestigious round number. Now, last time we were talking about weddings, and you were telling me about Albanian weddings and the customs therein. Have you been to any good weddings recently?
More and more, actually, I get pressure about my own wedding, actually, currently.
That's going to make it much more interesting, a podcast, so maybe we should talk about that.
But tune
maybe
in next
your
week.
Potential partner, potential wife might listen.
Indeed.
And maybe her comment would be that you don't listen, but how am I supposed to follow from that one?
That's a tough one. Yeah, where do we go from here?
Well, going back to expanding waistlines and forthcoming weddings, or not, as the case may be, you've clearly been doing lots of socialising in the fintech scene, professionally and personally. I'm not sure there's so much difference these days in the modern world. And what's your kind of feel, especially for those who weren't there either in time or in space, about the vibe of fintech 2014 when we were chatting then and the vibe in 2016? What's it actually like as a scene man?
I think it's a very good question, I think, because there's a lot of elements to that, both from our point of view as a small company, but then also as the industry at large, per se.
Yeah, let's forget your company for the moment. We'll spend enough time talking about that in a minute. So the industry as large, you know, what's it like hanging out in fintech scene rather than, I don't know, the media scene or the oil and gas scene?
I had a conversation just the other day in Asia, and the conversation went something along the lines of, when do you stop calling yourself a fintech?
Yes.
Because at some point, which we may have already hit, it's like calling yourself a .com. You very quickly got yourself away from that particular title.
There's a kind of albatross around your neck fairly soon. Yes.
Exactly, because yeah, when the taxi driver starts talking about fintech, then it's the time to stop calling yourself a fintech. Now, I think we're a little protected from that because in reality, we're market infrastructure change and always have been, and we're quite happy to attach ourselves to the fintech world. But I think as a part of the journey itself, as you know, you go from a startup to a scale-up, like you say, You know, are you perhaps leaning on other terms and other descriptions rather than the fintech thing? And the other part is when you see some of the meetups or conferences now, they're not meetups anymore, right? They're proper conferences now. The broad scale of, you know, what is fintech? There's insurance, there's personal stuff, there's the payments, you know, there's multiple streams in all of this thing. So it's quite a wide topic these days also.
Yeah, so you're talking about the fact that the brand value of fintech per se has changed. In 2014, everybody wanted to hang their hat on the word, not least of which because there were tons of money that had to be spent in fintech. Therefore, if you called yourself a fintech, you made yourself eligible and nobody ever bothered to define it. And as I've said many times in the show, there were a whole bunch of silos doing something completely different. You're completely different from Bitcoin, which is completely different from P2P, which is pretty much completely different from equity crowdfunding, which is completely different from insurance. And I'm talking about Lending Club. We're in Metal Box here, which is where Ratesetter started. They've now moved more centrally in the city. We're in Southwark, just below the river, just southwest of the cathedral, for those that know of Southwark Cathedral in London. And certainly, Ratesetter and all the other big UK P2Ps a year ago were getting tremendously excited when all corporate financiers kept knocking on their door and saying, you know, hello, Mr. Chief Executive, you know, if you do a successful float later in this year, you could be worth £100 million, which is a round of drinks in America, but over here it's a lot of money. Now, of course, at that time it was really cool calling yourself a P2P, the subset of fintech and all that. However, a year later when Lending Club's price has tanked by 50%, maybe, you know, the branding has changed. But this is all part of the evolution. Talking of Asia, I mentioned many times the fact that Asia, I think, has never lost the concept of life being this continual flux, this continual change. Whereas for us, Heraclitus died a long time ago. No one really bothered talking about the fact that everything's changing ever since, really.
Well, on the Asia things, so I was in Hong Kong in January, end of January.
It's obviously all this business travel that's made you a bigger man, shall we say.
Indeed.
As well as the greater testosterone, which comes from being a successful fintech scale-up.
Foreign exchange is a global business. You've got to be there. But the thing in Hong Kong I think might be relevant and interesting. It was a fintech show all about Hong Kong, sponsored by the government of Hong Kong, partly to attract foreign companies to come and set up there, but also partly to influence its own ecosystem locally. Now, one panel was particularly interesting. There was a lawyer, a VC, and an angel investor.
That sounds like a start of a good joke, actually.
It does, doesn't it? Yeah.
There was a lawyer, a VC, an angel investor in a bar.
That's what we should rename the podcast, perhaps. So the three of them talking about Asia, and in particular China. So the VC was particularly interested in anyone who was using Hong Kong as a base to attack China. The lawyer was telling the story how at that point, 1,000 peer-to-peer platforms in China had just gone broke. Shanghai Stock Exchange had taken a big dump, and 1,000 of these companies had gone. But it was okay, because there were another 2,000 of them still around. So when we look here at, you know, hey, peer-to-peer platforms here in the UK, there's a dozen of them maybe, 3,000 of them in China. Now, the reason why it was a story, and this is where the regulator piece sort of comes into it, is because they were taking the money and investing it in the stock market.
Which is not entirely unknown over there.
Now, they were allowed to. They weren't breaking the law. They weren't doing anything wrong. But there was no regulatory oversight to say to them, hey, hang on a second, if you're going to do peer-to-peer lending, you can't just go and put it in a margined stock account, which, of course, all got taken out in, you know, course of two afternoons. So there's that's the extra piece on the end of it, was companies who were using Hong Kong for their base for Asia, but also as a way of breaking into China, but who had regulatory oversight. And that was the troika of success as far as the local VC was concerned. Now, there's a lot of changes been going on the regulatory side, both in Asia and here. You have the FCA just doing its first tech sprint, you know, a pseudo hackathon that's very new and different for them. You've got Monetary Authority of Singapore looking at doing something similar. This is the other big element to a lot of, you know, what this industry is about. Unlike the tech world, it has a regulator. It's people's money. There are rules. And that makes a big difference for a lot of the stuff.
Yes, it's been an interesting thing for me. I've got a very prestigious guest coming on next month, which I'm hoping to record with, which we'll see when it comes through, to talk about some of these super big picture things. But one interesting journey for me has been around the whole entrepreneurialism and that kind of stuff. And in particular, in this context, I've been influenced, A, about my own thinking about financial services and banking and what's wrong with it all, and B, by listening to a lot of Noam Chomsky, YouTubes. When I was at college, Chomsky was well known for his linguistics and his Chomsky Type 2 languages, which fits in computer languages. And now he's very well known and very old and wise, talking about the politics of it all. He was quoting Alan Greenspan in the past as having talked about, you know, 100 successes of the American free market system and gone through them. Apparently, Chomsky wrote an article pointing out that 98 of these were actually government initiatives, which eventually went into circulation. And just relating it back to my point about banking, all the sort of whinging from the amateurs who don't understand FS saying, oh, it's because bankers are evil and stupid and, you know, yardy, yardy, yardy. Whereas actually, what a lot was going on, like in last week's episode number 51, when we were talking about business overdrafts, it's because the international regulations have changed over how much capital you need to allocate to overdrafts. In this particular case, you've got to allocate under the new rules enough capital to cover the maximum utilization, whereas actually normally they're just 50% utilized on average, and therefore it makes it look unattractive. So I've really actually, as much as I'm for quotes free enterprise and that kind of stuff, I think I'm much more appreciative of the fact that just like in a game of football or in a game of rugby, the behavior you see the boys and girls doing is almost entirely a function of the rules and parameters you're setting.
Mm. No, I agree. As a New Zealander, we know a little bit about rugby. But you're right, the rules change and the game changes, particularly on telly, right? Or worse, I sit there and think, hey, hang on a second, what did he just get? Why was a whistle blown for that? That's allowed, isn't it? I think you get a similar sort of thing here, and this sort of regulatory change or regulatory acceptance of a number of these new initiatives is a fundamental change, and it's partly because it's a barrier for a lot of them to grow. Like you say, if there's a capital restraint on a particular model, they need the capital, otherwise they're not going to go there, which turns a sexy cool fintech into a clunky old fuddy-duddy system very, very, very quickly. At the same time, it's also a competitive barrier for the next guy to try and come along.
Absolutely. I mean, I've had a whole show on the fact that regulation is becoming the new barrier to entry in the UK. If you turn up to the FCA and say, well, look, you know, I'm P2P, and I've got this great idea, I'm a triangle, and you explain the triangle, and they will listen and say, oh, those are interesting. So you've got three sides, three corners, yada, yada. But then they are forced to actually, they've got regulation. They're forced to say, okay, glad you're a triangle. Now, are you a square or a circle? Because yeah, what the regulation prescribes, you know, and that's why banking looks the way it does. That's why why challenger banks end up looking like the incumbents, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So it's a new one. And going back to the perversities and complexities beyond all the sort of simple spin, it is, in a sense, perhaps an interesting comparison to look at the progress or lack of progress in America, the land of freedom and opportunity and all that kind of stuff, around equity crowdfunding.
Yeah.
Over recent years, where not a lot's happened, and it's utterly bogged down in these sort of complicated Schedule 7, Title 3s, blah, blah, blah. And on the other hand, China, where thousands are being formed and going bust every day because there's no rules whatsoever. So I think we can assume that in the middle, there's a right amount. So moving on from the sort of, you know, the theory and the observations of the world, and as you quite rightly point out before, the world is a place that fintechs have got to be in. What have you learnt in 2016 about being CEO or about being a fintech that you didn't know in 2014? What would you have told yourself? What kind of lessons along the journey?
If I could send an email to myself.
Yeah, exactly. Yes, pay attention to this.
Don't worry about XYZ.
Yeah.
And do worry about ABC.
I saw a film about that. I forgot what it was.
It's kind of a Doctor Who sort of thing, really, isn't it? If I could get in my TARDIS.
Someone was in a library somewhere, and actually they wrote in some book on the library, and they were trying to influence the younger self to pick it up and read this margin note or something.
There's definitely a film somewhere in that one. I think, you know, our learnings are probably quite similar to what you would expect, right? Hiring the right people, building the right product. Once you've got the money, right, okay, we're off to now go and you know, deploy the business plan as it goes, get out there, get the first few customers, get the feedback from them, build version 2, exactly what you would expect. Probably the similar sorts of learnings that you would get in any small company, the difference being that there's not a lot of margin for error, right? There's not a lot of room for fat in any of these fintech startups. If you make a mistake, it can kill you, and you're expecting to make a couple of mistakes. And your ability to recognize them and turn change from them quite quickly. So we adjusted our business model quite heavily twice internally, customer driven, but recognize that, hang on a second, if we keep banging our head on the wall on this particular
angle, it's not going to work.
I guess you could call it a mini pivot, yes. But at the same time, common sense, right? This thing over here seems to be working. The one over there does not seem to be working.
let's go do more of the other one. Now that changes the business plan as a result. Not necessarily everybody agrees with it, but it's the one that customers tend to be buying, so let's go and do that one. And you evolve as a result. I think, you know, we shouldn't be afraid to make those changes, but as I say, in a world where you're not a large company that can absorb something that didn't quite work properly, you have to be careful about that kind of thing.
Yes, it's the kind of the inverse model. Again, just talking about last week's episode, Growth Street, we're talking about having spent a year working on their systems before they actually put them out to the public, which is the opposite of typically what a large American IT vendor does. It sort of ships it fast and sorts it all out further down the line.
Later, yeah.
So that's clearly one of the things about the fintech world, which is that the fin means you can't lose people's money in a software error or get things wrong like that.
Or even we produce it in the colour yellow and actually they want it in the colour green. Simple things like that.
I'd say that kind of stuff is the tech end, and the tech world is very used to, you know, the whole A-B testing over slightly different shades of purple and seeing what the response rate varies and that kind of thing. I wonder whether, touching on the fact that there is a vast financial services business network worldwide, I wonder whether another factor is that there isn't just far more competition in financial services already compared to, I don't know, being a Snapchat or a WhatsApp or something like that. Of course, there's competition in everything. But it's very easy, going back to the fluffy bunnies, it's very easy to underestimate how good, for example, Citigroup is at FX. They've done it for a long time, they've done a hell of a lot of it, and they are doing a hell of a lot of it, you know.
Or the way in which your business changes in different parts of the world, right? So in Asia, the whole idea of customer entertaining is very, very different to what we have here in the UK, which is a mildly more available version than what you can have in the United States. You know, you are literally not allowed to buy a person a beer or take them to dinner, or something like that. Asia, completely different story, wide open. And if you're not out there buying big expensive dinners and taking them to shows and stuff, then there's something wrong with your product. When there's nothing wrong with your product, it's just, okay, you've got to recognize that you do things very, very differently. China's considerably different. I was just there last week. You've got a world there where a lot of the internal systems within the country are not terribly advanced from a technology point of view in the banking world. And yet there's an army of people deployed to do anything new. Completely different way of doing business there as there is to say Hong Kong or Singapore. Totally different.
So cultural localization is a challenge even in this so-called globalized world. And globalization, picking up some Chomsky type ideas, globalization is actually just a metaphor for, quotes, the West, i.e. Europe and America, stamping its view of what life and society is on everybody else. And we won't mention the 800 military bases around the world and the non-stop wars, but there is actually, to me, a sort of neo-imperialistic thing going on here. Moving on from getting sucked into the political quagmire, so if we go beyond the bullshit and the hype and all the crap that was around in FinTech 2014, and there still is around and a large number of people still keep talking that way at the moment, I suspect that what one finds, like the usual thing about growing up, is a more nuanced view, which is actually there are some advantages to fintech, that loosely using the word fintech without getting into the whole point, and I accept your point. There are some advantages to that, but also there's some disadvantages, or rather the incumbents have got some great advantages. So how have you found that part of the journey?
The incumbent is exactly that, right? They already have the network. They already have the customer doing whatever it is with them. Customer may not be happy about it. It might be quicker, cheaper, faster, better for them to do it with you. But at the moment, they're doing it the way that they've always done it. And that's part of the appeal, but part of the opportunity as well is, okay, how quickly can you convert a number of those people over to the new way of doing things? And that works for anything. But when it comes with people's money, they do tend to be a bit clunky. Banks by far are the worst. So a lot of these fintech opportunities that are out there that are being deployed and being chased because of banks' inability to innovate or their difficulty to bring to market new products when they used to be very, very good at that kind of thing. So there's the opportunity. Complicated a little bit if banks are your customer, because they're actually worse now than they've ever been. There was an ITA report out a couple of months ago that gave you some statistics on just how slow banks have become in terms of onboarding new things into their own systems and into their own networks. Now, you know, there are fintechs that are trying to work with banks, there are fintechs that are trying to work against banks. The result is still the same though, that
banks have all the customers and they've got all the products already, whether they work or not terribly well, kind of doesn't matter. So you've got that process of trying to essentially rip customers away and drag them sometimes off into this new world. Once they're there, they're like, oh, this is loads better. You're like, yes. Well, you know, told you.
Exactly. And again, so my observation over the couple of years is that actually it's been easier to acquire B2C customers. It's easier for a rate setter to pick up the likes of URI. We stick a couple of grand in, see how it goes, and we're satisfied. And again, generalizing, but it's almost entirely the case that those fintechs over the last couple of years that have been trying to sell to banks in London, who I gave advice to freely and happily along the way, oh no, it can't be that bad, I found that it's far worse. You know, you've got sales cycles that take you 2 years to sell a pencil into a large organization, and I'm not particularly exaggerating too much, you know.
No, you're not. I mean, we have a friend in a bank, he actually just recently changed bank, who had this, you know, over a beer story of how he wanted to bring on a new service. It wasn't our one, but it was a similar sort of thing. He had to get 82 signatures.
Bloody hell.
And showed them to me, like, there you go, there's the 82 signatures I had to go and get from all the various different departments and committees, etc. And this was for them to do something that was very normal, nothing out of the ordinary for them at all. In fact, I was surprised that they didn't already offer that particular product. This is the kind of internal problem that you have for banks. The other thing is, you know, say for instance, friends of ours in Asia who are tracking 1,000 fintechs globally and who sit there and say, well, I think about 95, maybe more percent of them aren't making any money, or at least I haven't broken even yet. And these are the sorts of the reasons why, is these massive delays in terms of onboarding products within the financial community, whether it's because of the regulator, because of compliance, because it's procurement, because it's a new company, because it's just literally a new way of doing it, or there's a committee that all has to say yes. The whole thing just takes time. That's regardless whether it's the greatest, sexiest, brand new, fantastic product on the planet that everybody wants to use, you've still got to deal with that sort of process. And you end up with this, A, quite a few hangers on onto the whole sort of fintech, you know, surfboard as it were, falling off pretty quickly because, okay, we'll go out there and give it a try, and you'll find that actually, yes, lead times are a lot longer. So you've got to have a brilliant new thing with the right team, a good product, all the usual sorts of stuff. Otherwise, you just won't make it.
Yeah, and that's also that all those things are necessary, but not sufficient.
Exactly.
You can have all the right ingredients to bake the cake, but if the oven, relatively speaking, if the oven is cool, the cake ain't going to cook very fast.
So you end up pivoting over to another group of customers that sign up and deploy the thing quicker.
That's one angle. I mean, the other angle it leads into is the investor angle. You know, and you've got a prestigious investor, but not particularly talking about yourself, but more across the spectrum. A lot of fintechs though, over the couple of years have found that be careful what you wish for, you might actually get it. So they've got good investment from VCs and they think it's wonderful, and the VC's written the check out and the check's cash now, and as you say, got all the money and build it and all that. And then a few months down the track, they miss some KPI, and before you know it, some bloke's standing with a baseball bat and your ex-best friend is smacking you upside the head. And it ain't much fun. And then, you know, you're being threatened with losing your job unless you do this rather than the other. And, you know, so that's another realpolitik. And how do the classes of investor and how does sort of choosing the right investor make a difference?
I mean, it does. I mean, choosing the right investor is incredibly important. I mean, we've been very, very lucky.
Talking of marriages as we started, it's kind of marriage, really.
It is a marriage. It is considerably a marriage, as it is with your big customers and your technology as well. You're very beholden to all of them. So you must have an extremely good working relationship with them. Otherwise, you're going to run into these sorts of problems down the road. The other piece, I think, is probably valuation. I think the sorts of things that get backed, you know, everybody loves a nice big headline, you know, such and such valued at $1 billion, or, you know, raises $100 million, these sorts of things. Most of the stuff in the fintech space, it has to be realistic on its valuation. Otherwise, it does not attract the relevant investment monies, particularly here in Europe. United States is a different story. It's always got another zero on the end of it.
Exactly. But even in the United States, let's say with Lending Club, we've seen that, okay, you can get something away at valuation X, but to justify X, you've got to keep being exponential everything.
Yes.
Otherwise, you know, you get a real caning.
Or you operate in a very, very large marketplace, which has a daily turnover of X billion or trillion or however many. And so all you have to do is slowly chip yourself away a decent chunk of market share and you become a very valuable thing to typically a large complementary player in that marketplace who sees you as like, well, that's an easy way for us to get access into that world, and we don't have to do all of the jumping through hoops that that fintech company has done.
Yes. So that also brings us on to another element of the realpolitik, which is the complexity, and this is slightly zoom for investors, but it's the complexity of the relationships between what we might call, let's avoid the fintech word, new FS and old FS. So, you know, you've probably got a situation where you've got an old FS investor, you've got old invest clients, you've got old FS competitors. So it's, you know, compete, cooperate, and everything in between. So how do you see that sort of having worked out over the last couple of years?
If there wasn't any new in there, then we wouldn't have bothered doing it in the first place.
But you're getting older, you see. You're sort of on your way to being old FS yourself.
I am old FS.
I don't know what comes between new and old, medium or teenage FS. No, teenagers, no, you're a bit more than teenage, but...
Teenage.
Young adult, 20-something FS.
Tweeny, yeah. That's a very good example, actually, because, yes, you're dead right. A lot of our customers are very, very old school, shall we say. But the growth in our particular part of financial markets is all about from the new customers. Our focus is entirely on emerging market economies. These are all new clients for almost any product, you know, whether it's insurance or banking or credit cards or whatever. From an FX point of view, we're a primary market. We're much higher up the chain. But that is where all of the growth comes from. So in some respects, you know, it is a little bit of a merger in terms of those new customers and new economies coming online into the global economy that as a result are looking towards new FS products and services as a way to either get themselves up the chain or even leapfrog their competitors and friends, you know, in New York, London, Hong Kong, etc. The Chinese are a perfect example of that. That internal financial market is still very, very new. And you see them looking towards fintech companies, but also existing banks and other financial services outside of China that they've been purchasing as a way to, okay, you know, how do we build our own internal financial markets quickly? You know, it's a little bit like the M-Pesa example in Africa, right? How do you go from having no technology and not much going on to being the world leaders in that thing by using something as simple as a mobile phone?
Or mobile phones in large parts of Africa, sub-Saharan Africa, where you suddenly go from nothing to having exactly the same that people have in New York, Tokyo and London.
Yeah, and pretty much inventing mobile commerce, right? Yeah. So you've got the same sort of thing there. You have a large, large part of Asia all sitting there focused around China, following China in some respects, doing a lot of international trade back and forth between the two. And our focus is things like what's going on between China and Indonesia, for example, in terms of financial markets, where there are multiple things going on, or whether it's Korea, or whether it's Malaysia, or whether it's Australia even, in terms of those channels. Now, that's where there's the big opportunity for new FS to step into that realm so that you're not tied up in the same old clunky way of doing it.
Exactly. So going back to if we dissolve the word fintech and if we, as it were, created various dimensions in an Excel spreadsheet, one of them would be the geography of the marketplace. And, you know, in FX, arguably, there isn't much for fintech to do on dollar-euro. Because do you know what? The banks have heard of that before, and there's no way that any fintech's going to get sort of 10% of the sort of dollar-euro market. I'm very happy to put a bet on that. But as you say, there are other markets where the fact that we're just dropping the word fintech completely, you are a new FS player.
Exactly.
And that's a relatively new market, and you don't have the legacy technologies and all that kind of stuff. So actually, you know, you can compete a little sort of faster and nimbler in those marketplaces. And it's an interesting way of thinking of segmenting fintech a different way, which is by the marketplace and how new it is.
And I'll give you a perfect example. I'll give you a perfect example of that. So I was recently in India with the Lord Mayor of London.
Not that we're name dropping.
And not that we're name dropping. No. Okay, well, you can cut that bit out if you like. I was in India recently.
No, I'll leave it in because it's even more embarrassing that way.
With a delegation that included...
A delegation in Delhi.
Well, they were in Delhi, yes. I joined them in Mumbai.
A Mumbaigation.
You know, that delegation is in order to try and get more activity between India and the City of London across all sorts of things, insurance, banking, trading, financial services, all sorts of stuff. The two best parts about that entire trip were what the Indians were up to that London should be doing. So the Bombay Stock Exchange has an entire floor dedicated to fintech startups that they host and incubate themselves.
a lot of very, very clever stuff going on in there. Because it's the stock exchange, on their listing, A, the companies that are funding these guys, B, the companies that will probably buy the products that they're building, and C, the ones who probably actually buy the whole thing. They've got this fabulous little ecosystem going there. No other stock exchange in the Western world is doing anything like that. And, oh, hey, here you go. Bombay Stock Exchange. Brilliant. Brilliant idea, guys. Thanks very much. Can we borrow that?
Yeah, exactly. That sounds really interesting. And actually reminds me that of the millions of emails that get on LinkedIn, people wanting things for free always. No one ever says, oh, can I have something? And by the way, here's $5 or something. There was actually a guy last year from Mumbai, I think it was the Mumbai Stock Exchange, talking about podcasts and that, and, you know, picking my brains about how to do the Mumbai FinTech podcast. I'd never actually checked out whether there was a Mumbai FinTech podcast.
That might be them. That might be them. It's worth giving them a buzz back again. The other thing that they were doing, which was particularly interesting, is mini listings. So they were offering out stock exchange listings for $100,000, which is tiny, right? But for a lot of these FinTech companies trying to get their idea up and live and working, etc., to actually be IPOing essentially in some respects from the very, very get-go was very, very attractive. And the other thing is the kind of shareholder that that approached. So even if it was, say, $500,000 or $1 million worth of rupee, that's still a decent chunk of money in order for a fintech company to kick something off. But the shareholders that that attracted were the buy and hold types. Because, of course, the last thing you want is somebody to be shorting your stock on the exchange for some reason. But again, same sort of thing. No Western Stock Exchange is doing something like that. Bombay Stock Exchange had a whole bunch of these guys.
Yeah. Well, that fits very nicely to my narrative about what I see as neo-imperialism, sort of this whole sort of neo-con come free market philosophy, which is being stamped everywhere.
Yeah, but even the Romans, when they invaded in a country, they would take on the local customs.
This is exactly my point, though. It's all neo, and it's actually not like what it used to be, because there's all this arrogance, and the government gets reports commissioned saying the government's wonderful and, you know, the UK's the best in the world and all this kind of stuff, which is a kind of, frankly, imperialistic arrogance. Now, there are a lot of advantages to being in London, which is why there are a lot of London fintechs going, and I absolutely subscribe to that. And London is one of the top fintech places in the world. I absolutely subscribe to that. But once you start saying you're best, then actually what you don't do is look around the world and go, bloody hell, they're doing it. That's a really good idea. Let's have that. You know? And we had Alexander Gaillard, my buddy from the Swiss FinTech Association, on. He said, well, what Switzerland does, they look around and see what everyone else is doing. You know, this open attitude, and going back to the empire and Delhi and places like that, as I'm sure you know, in the original British in India, they went, quote, native. They learned the local language, married the locals, dressed as locals, and da-di-da-di-da-di. And it was only at the end of the whole thing when it had gone a bit sour. I wonder whether there's some lessons in this for America. When it's gone a bit sour, that actually there were stuffy Victorians looking down on the locals. You know, the original drive to get on boats and leave the country and go around the world was like there is today. Hey, Singapore's a bit more interesting than
very
London.
Very entrepreneurial.
Yeah, China's interesting. It's a fascination of going out and meeting other cultures and appreciating it. So that's a really interesting story to wrap up that realpolitik, which is not being too insular, not stuck in this Silicon Valley, New York, London kind of stuff. You know, that's as good as far as it goes, but actually there are some clever people all over the world. It doesn't matter what country you're from.
VC, the angel and the lawyer walk into a bar.
Yes, exactly. Yes, exactly. So just wrapping up that, John, so I occasionally watch Grand Designs, and Grand Designs has a revisited where they go back 3 years after a house has been built and say, so what it's actually like living in that house, you know, at the time it was all looking pristine and that. What's R5FX up to at the moment? Where's it going? And while I was just sort of sitting down, you were telling me about something very fascinating, which was involved lots of adjectives, and I couldn't quite remember what it was, to do with very complicated books. Anyway, R5FX.
Indeed, that would be the CCP club.
Yeah, funnily enough, that slipped my mind, yes.
Yes, which you need to be involved in our industry to understand what the hell that means.
Centralized counterparty, presumably CCP.
It is, and central limit order book.
So for 99.99999% of the audience, what is all that?
Well, a quicker, smarter, cheaper, easier way of doing it is essentially what that is, with a healthy amount of regulatory push into that direction. So essentially what that means is, rather than a one-to-one model, which is what the foreign exchange model works on, this is an all-to-all model, more centralized, more like a stock exchange type kind of model.
So for example, let's take one of your currencies. Give me an example. I'm trying to buy rubles.
You're trying to buy rubles. You're calling, say, one or two banks or even half a dozen banks that you have an existing relationship with to try and find out, okay, show me a decent price for that. Rather than that, you're coming to us where it's already got everybody's price already in it. and all prices are available to all people, which is something new and different for what's called bilateral credit markets.
Before we get complicated and use even more complicated phrases, so on the first bit, it's a bit like Amazon Marketplace. I have been sticking batteries into this thing for some time because my power supply unit failed and the new ones have cost a fortune. And then I noticed actually, rather than 35 quid, you can buy one for a fiver. I go to Amazon, it's got everybody's prices on. And, you know, funny enough, I hit the one that looks sort of reasonable to me. So the first bit is a centralized thing, which is you've gathered all the prices in one place.
Exactly.
So I've got that bit. I'm buying some rubles and I go there and I see everyone's prices. I don't just see John's R5FX price. I don't just see Citigroup's. Okay. And then the second part, which involves some more complicated, very FS-sounding words.
The wider part of that is once you're building a centralized market like that, then the idea of being all-to-all means you need as many customers as possible because you really do need the all part of it in order for that to work. That's the bit, of course, that takes all the time and effort is in terms of selling and installing and connecting up and bringing on new customers into our marketplace.
And sorry, what's a customer in your case? Is your customer a bank or is it somebody like me trying to buy rubles or both?
It's not the man in the street, but it is higher end financial institutions. So banks, hedge funds, asset managers, some brokers, something we call non-bank market makers, which is sort of a fancy kind of hedge fund method. So all of those sorts of people, they all have their role to play within the infrastructure or the fabric of the marketplace. This allows them a place where they can all trade with each other freely without any of the old school, clunky old ways of doing it problems that they used to have.
And what's the minimum kind of order size to go through something like that? You wouldn't do 1,000 new rubles from me.
No, our minimum trade is $1 million in increments of $1 million.
You say it's free. How do you make money out of that then?
Open to all, not free. Right. No, there's a brokerage charge in there, which the market is quite used to paying a brokerage fee in order to transact with each other. And the price to aggress a price is more expensive than it is to provide a price. We might be getting slightly a little bit too complicated there, but it's a brokerage model in the exact same way that the market knows and understands in that respect.
Okay. So as you explained that you've got to this, and I can see what the value is for all participants. Well, let's just call it simple. Marketplace in the BRICS, Brazil, I wish I hadn't started now, Brazil, Russia, India, China.
South Africa,
right. Well, I should have mentioned at the beginning what BRICS are. So where's R5FX going from here then, John? If I come back in 2 years' time, I'm still here and you're still here.
As indeed we will be. So things have gone very, very well. We have two offices, one in Asia, one here in Europe. We've doubled or tripled the size of the number of people that we had, I think, when we first spoke. We're now opening up China, India, Russia, Mexico, Indonesia to some extent, Colombia also. So we're very busy in a number of these underlying economies globally, both from a government point of view as well as from a fintech or a technology new service point of view also. Combination of that has been very, very powerful, I have to say. The graph goes up every month, which is also a nice thing. Again, very, very difficult thing to achieve, a graph that grows all the time.
Well, it depends if it's expenses. I think most of us can grow expenses quite well.
yes, indeed.
Which graph is the question?
Keeping a handle on those is also, that's always a tricky bit, particularly in a growing business, right? That's an easy one to cut your
own particularly throat. One where you're creating infrastructure. You have to create the infrastructure before people actually sort of buy it, really.
Agreed.
It's a bit like a property project. You know, you have to create the building. You've got to dig foundations and build it all and fit it all out before actually people start flooding in, you know.
Even some of our existing friends and family around this talk about it in that manner, actually, that a good chunk of the hard work has been done. And now it's a matter of moving to process. You know, how do you sharpen your process? How do you make your process simpler and quicker and easier, because now that you've proven that the thing works.
So it's interesting. So we've touched on a few of the fin angles, but one of my feels from talking to you is, I don't mean this in a derogatory fashion, but A, life is messy.
Very.
And B, a lot of being a fintech scale-up is a bit like being a scale-up in any industry. There are some fin bits of it, but as time goes by, that's just kind of the daily fodder.
Yeah, I agree entirely. I mean, the challenges are different, but they're still there. And all the usual ones of, you know, cash and customers and having the right people and your timing and your product and the rest of it. Throw in regulatory change, regulatory uncertainty, compliance difficulties, you know, for your primary customer and the rest of it. But you're right, those are just the hurdles that you have to get over in our particular industry. Every industry has their own group of little, you know, hurdles and the rest of it. The ones that are do truly have something which is better will succeed. Those who partner with each other in order to get there will also succeed. The ones that are sort of attached themselves to this name fintech will get filtered out or fall off pretty quickly, as they already have, right? Where people are like, that guy's a waste of time. And you end up getting that shakeout as a result. That means that the ones that are left standing are actually pretty good businesses. They've got some good stuff in there, and it's worth supporting them.
Excellent. So I should give you a fiver, because you've saved me my usual headache of when I get to the end of the episode trying to remember the whole thing and recap it, because that's actually a very good recap. And I think my only meta recap on top of that, which is that for me, one of the lessons that's come out of talking to today, John, was that from 2014 to 2016, the companies that are surviving and thriving are, to use a phrase, those that are good businesses.
Agreed.
So thanks for that, John, and every good luck in the future.
Thank you very much.
Thanks for listening. If you enjoyed the show, please subscribe on iTunes or your podcast app, or sign up at londonfintechpodcast.com for email alerts and new episodes. Live long and prosper.
We could sit in a bender all day, watching the firelight dance, watching the firelight dance. We could walk in the mountains before dawn, watching a happy moon ride, watching a happy moon ride. To come away from the city, the tarmac so dead and the people so sad. Come away from the city, but with the faces so gray, with the pain of the everyday. The mountains and the trees. Can you see what I mean? Can you see what I mean? We fit in between the earth and the sky. Kiss the city goodbye. Wave the city goodbye. Wave the city goodbye. City goodbye. Watch the firelight dance with me. 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 Watch the firelight dance.